In today's episode, it's time for some end-of-season updates, including the Season 7 listener question and a big travel announcement. And later, I'll talk to Dave Mertz, Program Chair of the Building Preservation Program at Belmont College in St. Clairsville, Ohio. But first, I'm Stacy Grinsfelder from Blake Hill House, and I am the host of True Tales from Old Houses. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the last episode of Season 6. Here we are already. I don't know what it's like as a listener, but as the host, the time goes by so fast. And we've covered a lot of ground this season, too. We talked about finding contractors, tips for plumbing emergencies, house stories from the UK, Milwaukee, New Brunswick. Then there was the live audience event in the Hudson Valley. It's really been a whirlwind, and I have loved every second of it. Thank you so much for being here. And even though the show will be on a short break until Season 7 starts on Monday, February 28th, you can still email me or leave a voicemail on the True Tales from Old Houses website or the Blake Hill House blog. And I'll be here preparing for the next season of the podcast and hopefully, finally, finishing the staircase restoration here at my house. That staircase project has dragged on forever, and I'm really ready to move on mentally and physically. The bathroom remodels also continue, so there'll be updates about all of that just right on the blog. Okay, what else? Oh, during the break, if you have a moment, I would love it if you would leave a positive rating or review for the show wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Over the past couple of weeks, we've received some very thoughtful reviews, and they are so appreciated. Your ratings and reviews help keep True Tales from Old Houses on the charts, and that means that other old house lovers can find the show and start listening too. Reviews are especially helpful during the break when I'm not releasing new episodes. There's also an end-of-season survey link on the sidebar of the True Tales from Old Houses website. So if you have feedback about this season or the show in general, filling out that survey will take about 5 minutes. If you have an idea for a guest, ways the show could improve, I mean, anything really, that survey is the perfect way to let me know. And don't worry if you filled it out before, you're welcome to do it again. You might have something new to tell me, and I am all ears. I feel like a teacher who just assigned a boatload of homework over winter break. You don't have to do any of that. Leaving a review, filling out the survey, it is all extra credit. And I promise it will not affect your overall grade. But you overachievers out there, I see you. All right, I do have a few announcements today. In fact, I have quite a lot to tell you, so I'm not doing a listener Q&A segment this episode. But please do send me more questions. There was quite a backlog for some time, and now the listener question coffer, it's looking a little empty. I think we've answered pretty much all of them, except maybe a few repeats. I do have pros and friends on standby for next season, and we're excited to offer up advice and help you out if we can. You can send me those questions via the contact page on the website or through a direct message on social media, whichever is easier for you. Announcement number one. I know that COVID has put a halt to many in-person events for the Old House community, but I want to remind you that if an organization that you're involved with is hosting an event, in person or otherwise, I would be happy to mention it on an upcoming episode. It doesn't matter to me if it's nonprofit or for-profit. I think initially I thought I would use this section for nonprofits only, but it doesn't really matter to me, honestly. If the function or gathering or fundraiser interests and benefits old buildings and the people who love them, consider me your community billboard. I want to help you spread the word. It's important. I have one such announcement today. My friend John Rogers brought this one to my attention. The Vail Mansion House Museum in Independence, Missouri, is currently seeking donations and funds to repair some very serious damage on the exterior. A few things to know, the Vail Mansion is considered one of the most iconic Second Empire homes remaining in the country. It is beautiful. John sent me some pictures and I am posting those on the show notes this morning. It is operated as a house museum by all volunteers. It's owned by the city with zero funding available for restoration. Sound familiar? And some of the issues are getting to the point that if they aren't addressed soon, the costs will skyrocket. And we all know what the next step is after that. Sadly, some of these treasures get bulldozed when the expenses get too high. We're not there yet, but John and the crew are trying to be proactive. So if this is a cause that speaks to you, please dust off your checkbooks and send donations to P.O. Box 316, Independence, Missouri, 64051. And please put Restoration Project on the memo line of your check. I believe that they are actually working on some forms of electronic payments too. Everything about this fundraiser will be over on the show notes, and I'll make updates if they do get that electronic payment system in place. And John, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. Next up, it is time to reveal the listener question for season 7. To clarify, this is the question that I ask you as listeners to answer throughout the season, not a question that you ask me. During season 6, so many of you wrote or left a voicemail to tell me your favorite thing about living in an old house and the most challenging thing about living in an old house. And before I tell you the new question, I want to share one final answer to the old one. It comes from Aaron. He wrote, "My wife and I own an 1891 historic home in Southwest Missouri. What I like the most about living in an old home is being part of the story of this house and trying to preserve it for future generations. What I dislike the most are the splinters from rough sawn fir." I read this and I thought, I understand that. My son actually got a super nasty splinter a couple weeks ago from our Doug fir floors. And I actually have a little piece of tape over that spot so I can repair it at some point. But they are nasty. Aaron went on to say, "Also, finding correct materials to maintain the house, as well as the impossibility of finding trade expertise where we are." Yeah, I think that finding materials and qualified tradespeople are real struggles for many, and I'll continue to keep my ears open. The network is larger than most of us know, so if you are looking for someone, shoot me a message and maybe I can connect you with some useful information. And that goes for all of you, not just Aaron. Good answer. So many good answers this season. Now it's time to reveal the question for season 7, and it is, drumroll please, or I don't know, fake drumroll please. What have you learned since buying your old house? Interesting. And I suspect that your answers will range from practical to philosophical, and I'm really looking forward to hearing them. Send those answers through the contact form on the website or leave a voicemail by clicking on the microphone icon on the bottom right-hand side of every page. Every page? Yeah, I think the mic icon shows up on every page of the True Tales from Old Houses website. And you can use it on your computer or your phone. It works either way. Again, the question for season 7 is, what have you learned since buying your old house? I can't wait to find out what you have to say. Now, switching gears a little, I did hear back from two listeners who were familiar with the Christmas tree in Boston Common sent from Nova Scotia. We've managed to actually spread little bits of this story into 3 episodes, and I love it so much. I like it when we were able to extend a story and keep making it better and bigger. So if you're just jumping in and you have no idea what I'm talking about, let me just quickly recap. During episode 67, I interviewed Joe Peterson from New Brunswick, Canada. In the opening segment of that show, I talked about the Halifax Harbor explosion that occurred in 1917. And that's Halifax in Nova Scotia. Joe followed up on our conversation with some additional information that I shared in episode number 68. Joe mentioned that after the explosion, Boston, Massachusetts sent aid right away to help the residents of Halifax, which was really, really nice. In 1941, Halifax started lighting a tree in the city center to honor Boston for their help. Then they took it one step further in the early 1970s. The powers that be in Halifax started sending a beautiful tree cut down in Nova Scotia to Boston as a thank you gift, and that's really where we left off. I wanted to know if anyone from Boston was familiar with the yearly Christmas tree in Boston Common, and 2 people said yes. Unfortunately, like the disorganized person I can be sometimes, I cannot find exactly what they wrote, but I believe one person had heard of it and the other person had actually received some education about the whole event and she had even seen the tree. Now, I don't know if this year's tree is still up right now. If so, it's probably getting pretty crispy, I would think. But if you're interested, take a look for it this year or check it out during the next holiday season. This whole story has really piqued my interest, and I would like to go to Boston to see the tree. I think it would be a full circle moment since I have already been to Halifax. If you have seen the tree in Boston, keep those stories coming. I'm still interested. Finally, I have one last big announcement, and it's about travel. It has been a long-held dream of mine to take this show on the road more often to really connect face-to-face with the Old House community and to beef up my sadly lacking history education. I'm still working on plans for more live audience events during 2022 here in the US, but on July 12th of this year, I am going on an 11-day trip to Scotland and Northern Ireland, and you can book the same trip and go with me. We can stare at old buildings together, learn the history of each region, try new foods, toast with a Guinness straight from the source. I can't wait. Our tour will start in Scotland, visiting Glasgow? I have some homework to do, don't I? Cruising the waterway of Loch Lomond, we'll see the Highlands and visit Edinburgh. And that's just scratching the surface. If you are an Outlander fan, this part of the trip should greatly appeal to you. We'll tour the Royal Yacht Britannia, which is the vacation home of Her Majesty the Queen and the royal family. Then we'll take a ferry to Belfast, learning about the Titanic, St. Anne's Cathedral, Queen's University. The tour includes the Giant's Causeway, which is the coastline of Northern Ireland, and fun fact, it is both a geological wonder and a World Heritage Site. The walled city of Derry is also on the itinerary, and I don't know if anybody else has watched Derry Girls on Netflix. I thought it was such a cute show. A lot crass, but very clever and surprisingly touching too, and I'm really interested in seeing Derry. And there's so much more. Glenveagh National Park, a whiskey distillery, the Guinness Beer Factory, Dublin Castle, St. Patrick's Cathedral. The schedule is packed, but there's also some downtime and individual exploration time built into the trip. I'm planning to record an episode of the podcast while I'm there and also take tons of photos to share, and I'll be writing a travel log too. I'm taking my mother with me, so you'll get to meet Grandma Vera, as we call her, and she is probably one of the sweetest people you will ever meet. You're going to love her. This is my first vacation with a tour company, but Grandma Vera is a veteran tour traveler and prolific knitter, and it's possible that you might end up going home with a knitted dishcloth in your bag, whether you wanted one or not. I know it's a lot of information, so here's how it works. I've partnered with Holiday Vacations for this trip, and they're providing a European tour guide for us while we're there. And there'll be local guides with personal and cultural and historical backgrounds to round out all of these experiences. Holiday Vacations provides all of our transportation, including airfare. And, you know, I feel like airfare isn't always included with tours, so I'm very excited about that. I think it'll really reduce the hassle overall. An initial $200 down payment is required to reserve your spot, but Holiday Vacations is planned for every contingency, including refunding all of your money if the tour does not run. The final payments for this trip are due April 8th, and you have until that day to cancel for any reason and still receive a refund. And I know that COVID makes everything a big question mark for so many of us right now. But keep in mind that this trip is 6 months away. And you can also purchase traveler's insurance if you're concerned that you might have to cancel after April 8th. But remember, if this tour doesn't go, you get your money back anyway. Oh, and I should add, speaking of money, I'm not taking your money. You aren't sending anything to me. Holiday Vacations is in charge of all of that. So to see the full itinerary of this trip and all the details, go to holidayvacations.com, scroll down past the header image, and click on that red bar that says local station keyword. Our keyword is Stacy with no E, S-T-A-C-Y. And I know that might sound confusing, so I'm going to put the landing page link right on the website, right on our website, I should say, the True Tales from Old House's website. To book the trip and ask questions about those COVID protocols, the payment schedule, gratuities, refunds, anything you can think of, you can call toll-free to 888-867-2190. Again, that's 888-867-2190. And one of the tour sales consultants from Holiday Vacations will handle everything for you. And I really hope that some of you can go because it is going to be so much fun. All right. That was a ton of information. So thanks for sticking around. I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This show simply could not happen without them. And True Tales from Old Houses is supported by The Window Course from Scott Seidler of the Craftsman blog and the Plunger app. The Window Course is a step-by-step do-it-yourself program that will teach you everything you need to know to successfully restore your wood windows. It's self-paced, so you can go as fast or as slow as you need to. And as I've mentioned before, there are several price points to fit your needs and budget. Make taking the window course part of your New Year's resolution and get a jump on all of that window restoration work that you have on your to-do list. Now is really the perfect time to take the course and learn the process. You can make your plan, gather supplies, and you'll be ready to start when the weather turns warmer. And here's another little something that Scott is offering his students. If you sign up for the Lifetime Access Package or Training Package, then you also get a free infrared paint remover, which is a $130 value. What a deal! The window course is offered with a money-back guarantee, and I've still got a coupon code for you, too. Scott is offering True Tales from Old Houses listeners a special discount. For 10% off, visit thewindowcourse.com and use the coupon code TRUETALES. True Tales from Old Houses is also supported by the Plunger app, whose mission is to solve 100% of plumbing problems that don't require an on-site plumber. The Plunger app is free to download. Open the app on your phone or tablet, click Talk to a Plumber Now, and you'll be connected with a licensed plumber in your area who will help you troubleshoot and solve your plumbing problems with a face-to-face video chat. Now, I'm in charge of some of the finished plumbing in our guest bath, and I will definitely be using help from a pro at Plunger. Subcontractors, they are so busy these days, and what I love is that I can actually use this app on my schedule. I pick the day, and when I get stuck, and I know I will, I'll call Plunger and the plumber will talk me through the work for a fraction of the cost of hiring a plumber to come to my house to do it. If you need parts, Plunger can ship everything you need right to your front door. Plunger truly is plumbing for the people. So here's what you need to know. Download the free Plunger app at plunjr.com/download. Tap Talk to a Plumber Now to solve your problem. Put those little plumbing issues back on your to-do list because you can do this. And if you mention the True Tales from Old House's secret word flapper, your first call is only $10. Use the secret word flapper to save and be sure to tell them that I sent you. My guest today is Dave Mertz. Since 1989, Dave has been the program chair of the Building Preservation Program at Belmont College in St. Clairsville, Ohio. The Building Preservation Program offers a two-year degree based on a rigorous academic and hands-on restoration trades curriculum.
My name is Dave Mertz. I'm the program chair of the Building Preservation Program at Belmont College.
Nice to meet you, Dave. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I looked up Belmont College, and it is in St. Clairsville, Ohio. And where in the world is St. Clairsville, Ohio?
St. Clairsville is about 10 minutes west of Wheeling, West Virginia, right on I-70. So if you've driven through, you know, Ohio and Indiana, Illinois, and Western Pennsylvania, you know where I-70 is, or you can see it from the interstate.
Is it a university town or college town or?
Belmont is a two-year public community college, and so most of our students are local and commute. The BPR program, however, does draw people from all across the country, so there's really not a college town atmosphere. It's a very rural setting.
So you've been the program chair of the Building Preservation and Restoration Program since 1989, and I'm just curious about your personal path. How did you get there?
I graduated with an architecture degree from Kansas State. I'm originally from Eastern Pennsylvania. I went to community college there. I transferred to Kansas State because Kansas State was one of the few colleges that actually accepted community college credits at that time. If I would have gone to Penn State, I would have had to start all over again. I got my undergraduate and my graduate degree from Kansas State, and I applied for three jobs, and I took a job as an architect in Topeka for about a year, but we were a little bit homesick, wanted to get a little bit back closer to the family in Pennsylvania, and I applied to three jobs. I got two of them. I was supposed to start as the head architect for the West Virginia Main Street program, but the governor got indicted and everybody in the office was governor appointees and they were all scrambling to leave. And when I came in to look for an apartment in Charleston, the president of the college had called me and said, "Hey, come on up. It's close." And I came up and interviewed for the job, and that's how I ended up doing it.
So how did you get interested in historic preservation?
Believe it or not, I had two choices. When I got done with my undergraduate program, I had two choices in graduate school in the architecture department, either gerontology or historic preservation. And I always had a love for older buildings. And so I went that route.
That's really interesting.
And the teaching side of things was something that I just really enjoyed in grad school. Did some teaching in grad school and didn't think I would get back into it that quickly after getting out. But, sometimes we just kind of follow the way the ball bounces. And I just ended up at Belmont. I didn't know. I've been there 32 years. And the opportunity came to start this program. And never looked back.
So why did Belmont College start the program?
The president at that time, a gentleman by the name of Steve Meridian, and a local politician by the name of Bob Ney. Bob's kind of famous, unfortunately, for the Abramoff scandal.
Oh, I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, he was at that time in the state Senate. And he was head of the Finance Committee, and he was able to get an earmark of about $300,000 for the president to start a new program. Steve was from Boston. He was familiar with historic preservation. I think he wanted at that time to do something that was more academic in a kind of a traditional sense. And when I interviewed for the job, I said, students coming out of a 2-year program like that with a degree in historic preservation on the academic side are going to be up against students that are coming out of 4-year and primarily graduate programs and weren't going to stand a chance in the job market. I said, the gap is really in the trades, and there's really nobody doing that, or very few, doing that. And so I guess that's why I got the job.
I have been really very interested in the history of shrinking vocational and technical programs in high schools, especially because that all started to happen when I was a student. And I went to high school in the rural Midwest, and I think those small country schools hung on to their vo-tech programs probably longer. A little longer maybe than larger urban schools. They saw technology as the future. And it's still kind of like that. Do you feel like there's a hurdle in getting people interested in the preservation trades at an hands-on and academic level once they get to in the age group that's interested in your program?
Yeah, I think there's still an issue with that. I think it's starting to turn, but ever so slowly. I mean, it took a long time to get to that point. And it's a complicated problem that's grown into where it is today. You're right. It was due in large part to the rise of technology, the rise of the community colleges and private universities and colleges across the country, and the idea that every kid should be going to college mentality established kind of a goal at the high school levels that we should be pushing these kids, at a very young age, basically, to be college prep and to go that direction. And so kids that historically maybe would have gone towards the trades and stuff were now being pushed towards more academic careers. And unfortunately, the kids that didn't do well in school, and often because of learning disabilities, got pushed towards the vocational side of things. So there was a stereotype about vocational education that basically it was a school for the dummies, and the trades became associated, unfortunately, with that for a long time. Parents pushed their kids, the parents wanted their kids to go to college, and part of the whole Belmont idea was that if you can't beat them, join them, and make the trades education in the auspices of historic preservation something that is an attainable college degree. And I can't tell you over the years, especially in the early years, how many parents came to me and said, well, I don't know what I would have done. We felt like we failed as parents, but our son or daughter got a college degree now and we're happy. That's unfortunately the system that we built kind of in America. But I think in recent years, there's been a beginning of a change. You've got a lot of kids who are getting 4-year college degrees that aren't finding work in their fields, and people with degrees from a technical school that have skills in the construction area are making good incomes. And it's going to take time for that stereotype to go away. People like Mike Rowe are pushing hard to try to change that mentality on a national level. And I think we need to do more things like that on a national level in order to get it to swing. But that's where we are now, at least in the industry, and hopefully that will change in the coming years. I know that there are contractors right and left, both new and historic preservation contractors, that are turning down work simply because they can't get the work for them.
Yeah, so many of them can't find people. You're exactly right. So, but I wanted to say, it's funny because I came up through high school during that time of the shift. And I have to admit that I am just as guilty as some people. I mean, I thoroughly appreciate the trades. I talk about the trades a ton on this show. And yet I was taught that this 4-year degree was a form of freedom. You know, get that 4-year degree in something, anything, and doors will be opened for you. And obviously, this is a degree program that you are leading. But what would you say to people like me who are open to a shift in thinking, but maybe they just can't get there on their own?
Yeah, I think we try to, you know, we get a lot of students, actually. You'd be surprised, maybe about a third of our students are right out of high school, but about a third are students that have gotten an undergraduate degree but want the technical side of historic preservation in terms of that training, and so they can market themselves better. And then a third are people that are going through career changes, you know, and often it's life events that drive them to make that choice. They want to do something they love, you know, and they've decided to come back to school, and Belmont is a good choice for them because it's relatively inexpensive. It can often be done in, you know, the program can be done usually in a year, year and a half, if you already have some college, you know, classes behind you. They come forward and then never look back. Sometimes those are the best students that we get.
Sure.
Because they're more mature. This is what they love. This is what they want to do. So they come to the program with a fantastic attitude from the very beginning. And because they are mature and because they've been in the workforce for years often, they can see the value of what they're learning. They can see how to apply it in the years to come. And so they tend to be very successful.
Yeah, I've yet to interview somebody on this show in the restoration trades who said, I've been doing this since right out of high school. Almost all of them have had career before they ever started this. You know, there's been actors and teachers, a lot of desk jobs where they realize, oh, I don't want to sit behind a desk anymore. I want to get out there and do some work and, you know, do something meaningful, something that means something to me and maybe means something in the future.
There's a feeling that you get inside. Ruskin, John Ruskin would say it's as closest to God as you can get. That feeling of accomplishment when you've done a job and you've done it well and you go home at the end of the day and, you know, you've taxed your body a little bit, you're physically tired, but you sleep well. As compared to sitting behind a desk all day, a lot of people will sit behind a desk all day and then go home and try to find that, whether they are amateur woodworkers or something like that. But they're trying to find that feeling of success that you just don't usually find in a desk job.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So with a program like this, how does a program like a degree program benefit a person who could also enter the restoration trades as an entry-level worker and learn the skills on the job? I mean, that might be what you have to sell to some extent.
Yeah, and that's a recruiting issue. I mean, certainly we face that all the time. I will say that our students, when they get out, one of the things that benefit them by going through the Belmont program is the network of graduates that are out in the field that they can tie into and they can work within. A lot of the contractors that I deal with say the advantage of a Belmont student is that they're hiring. They know when they're hiring a Belmont student, they're getting somebody who persevered through the program so that they're serious about wanting to be in this business and do this kind of work. They know they've done this kind of work. We do a lot of field work in the program. So they've been out there in the cold. They've been out there in the rain working on buildings and getting dirty and things like that. And they have a background in knowledge about historic preservation in general. So they understand the big picture, what's going on in regards to this. They're not just, you know, working on wood. They understand what that wood is and the species of wood and how to work it and that kind of thing. So they bring a level of skill to the table that is far exceeds what a person walking off the street could be. I mean, if the contractor hires somebody off the street, it's a crapshoot in terms of what they're going to get. Often, you know, I hear horror stories of contractors saying, I hired so-and-so, they look like, they look good on paper. I interviewed them. Everything looked good. They came out. They worked the first week or a couple days and then never showed up again.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get that kind of person when you get a graduate of the Belmont program.
Well, and let's be honest too, not everybody is a good teacher. So the idea that they've been to school and been taught by great teachers already, and I guess when I say not everybody's a great teacher, I mean, when you go out into the world, sometimes you work for a company and your supervisor, your boss, you know, they know how to run a business, but they may not be the best teacher. So having going into that job, having already been taught by some of the best, well, there you go. You know, you can probably meet each other in the middle. Your new supervisor and the person who's working can meet each other where they are instead of having to build somebody up from the very beginning.
Yeah. And our network is such that we're, you know, we try to find out what the student is interested in, where their skills lie. Sometimes people like to do what they're not good at.
Yeah, guilty.
Sometimes, you know, sometimes you don't like to do it, but you're really good at it. And we try to find what you're good at and what you like to do, and then hook you up with somebody through our network to take you to the next level. So, you know, this is not something, you know, trade is like probably any other business. It's not something that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, some people are born with a unique advantage there, but it takes years to get really good at what you're doing. And it's a constant learning process. It's a lifelong learning process. And so, you know, the goal is to hook somebody up with somebody that's going to take them to the next level, not somebody who is going to, you know, basically say, you know, move these bricks from point A to point B all day long for the next 2 years.
Right, right. I talked to somebody who did plaster work, and somebody called him an expert, and he said, no, please don't call me an expert. He's like, an expert implies that I have nothing more to learn. Whereas I believe that this is an ongoing process. There's always something new and something I can take forward and a next level I can reach. And that stuck with me because so many people want to call themselves experts or declare that they've reached an expert level of something. And I don't know if that can be qualified in hours and minutes and time the way we want to.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, let's talk about this specific program, because I looked through it and I really feel like I want to take every class in it.
You don't know how often I hear that. Yeah.
I thought, ooh, sign me up. How far away is it? A little too far for a daily commute for me, but I am interested. But what kind of classes can students look forward to if they join the program?
Well, we divide it into basically three basic categories. There is an academic side of it, and I've had students that have compared the academic side of it to graduate school, and they've gone on to graduate school, and they said some of our classes are more stringent than what they had in graduate school. So, and I take pride in that we're trying to push a lot of information on people in a short amount of time. And so the academic side is history of American architecture. So you become familiar with stylistic changes that occurred in American history. We talk about the preservation movement and where it's at, history of it. So you understand that. It's important to know where you are in your field, how your field came to be where it is. We have students come in from all different backgrounds. And so we have what we call material methods of construction class that kind of brings everybody together, at least a basic background of what construction is involved and the materials used in it and the techniques. There's a building pathology class where we talk about how buildings fail or how materials fail and building systems fail and then, you know, offer up options in terms of repair. There's a construction management estimating class, all part of what we do, and a drafting class. We, you know, everything that we build, we draw it out first because it's about developing a mental process of learning how to think through a project. And I find that this is often a difficult area for some people.
Right.
The art students that we get sometimes are the worst because their minds just go in all different directions and they get themselves into a hole. You know, if we tell them to build a bracket, they're going to start building it without thinking through and it's going to be a mess. And so, you know, we draw everything out, and, you know, you figure it all out. You know how to put together in your head before you ever touch the material. That's how you say it.
That's interesting. I have one of my children is an artist, and I can see that. It's just a different way your brain works. It's neither bad nor good. It's just you can only apply your brain in so many ways and get the same outcome.
Exactly. I mean, they're very creative people. Sometimes they just need help in terms of processing that information into a way to create what it is that they're thinking about.
Right. Absolutely.
We also have what we call our material science classes. These are the fun ones that the students like, that they deal 1 hour of lecture and 6 hours of lab a week. And even they'll put even more time in the labs than that. Decorative finishes, wood, trying to think of the order here, masonry and ceramics, plaster, metals, and decorative stained glass are our six material science classes. And here we delve into that material very deeply. We use it. We have a series of exercises and projects that the students go through to build their skills when using those materials. So, for example, in plaster class, they'll go out on site, do flat wall work, scratch brown, finish coats. They'll make a medallion from scratch. They'll learn how to make rubber molds and how to sculpt in clay and run a piece of cornice. And then sometimes, depending on what the size of the class and how they're doing, sometimes we'll go out to a community project or something. Last year, I had a small plaster class. We went down, restored about 15 feet of cornice at a church that had water damage like 20 years ago and never had anybody to fix it.
Right.
And so we were able to do something like that. So, and then the final thing is the field work. And we do a lot of community service and field type work in the program. We own a house that is a lab that we, it's just a lab in process. I know I'm starting to get old because we're restoring things that we restored when I started. It's a great place for students to, play around and learn at no cost.
Right. I got a kick out of that. I was going to ask you, do you just have to keep tearing up the same place and starting over? Because eventually you get done, right?
Yeah, I know.
Lie to me.
Probably not, not
lie to me,
lifetime.
Please. Lie to us all. We all want to think there's an end at some point so we can start over.
When the program started, the idea was that we were going to do this house and then to kind of fix the house up. What we didn't realize was the demand from the community. And probably if I had to do it over again, probably wouldn't have gotten a house. There's just so much work for nonprofits and for local governments and things in the area that we could have easily maintained and kept busy without having the house as an overhead.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are you still able to do some of that community work?
Oh, yeah, we do. And that's why the house kind of drags on. If a project comes up that's of the scale that works, and if it's a timing is right, so that it fits into the curriculum, then we'll go ahead and take that on. Our windows and doors classes last fall finished the windows and did all the frames at a local historic railroad depot in St. Clairsville. We also did last summer at that depot, we did structural repair work to make sure that the building was now structurally sound. We're hoping that they're going to get a grant for to purchase slate and maybe in the fall be able to put a slate roof.
Oh, that'd be great. I just know of so many people in my area who don't do slate roofs because they don't know how, and nobody
exactly.
else knows how either.
There's very few people, yeah.
I live in Western New York, so we have a really wide variety of architecture and styles of houses, and people have to pick and choose preservation or not, because sometimes they just can't get people to do the work that needs to be done.
Yeah, and unfortunately, sometimes for an average homeowner, they call a roofer, and the roofer comes and tells them, "No, that can't be repaired. That's gone. It can't be replaced. Nobody's doing that anymore. I put asphalt up here." And, the other side of that is in residential work, it's difficult because the cost of a new slate roof often is maybe not able to get that back.
Absolutely.
So institutional buildings, churches, things like that, where, you're looking at it, where the 100-year lifespan of a slate roof like that is very valuable, because hopefully that those organizations will continue on beyond a person's lifetime. It's more difficult to sell a slate roof to a homeowner.
And it is, I should say, it is a privilege to be able to afford something like that as a homeowner, especially someone who may not live in their home for more than 4 or 5 years. So I don't discount that at all. I guess I'm just observing how things unfold around me. And I mean, my town has 90% of the inventory are historic houses. I mean, they're old, they're pre-war. So it's it's a crash course in architecture and design and preservation here.
Yeah. Perfect place for somebody to set up a slate repair business. Yeah.
That is true. Yes. So after completing your program, what degree do these students earn and where do they usually go from there?
Okay, well, they get an Associate of Applied Science in Building Preservation. And then the options are open. We'll have some students that will go on and further education. So that, like I said, that they're not interested in necessarily being a tradesperson, but they wanted the technical side of historic preservation. They wanted to understand the technical side. And unfortunately, most graduate programs don't typically deal with. And so sometimes they'll go off and get an undergraduate degree. Sometimes they'll go off and get a graduate degree. Because some, you know, we have a lot of students that come to us with undergraduate degrees. And we do have some students that come with graduate degrees. And they'll go off and they'll work for state preservation offices and a technical office. They'll go work for architects, things like that. We have other students that work for construction companies, so the general construction companies. We have some students that work for specialty contractors, like stained glass companies or plastering companies or timber framers or things like that. We have some students, the Historic Preservation Training Center in Frederick, Maryland, which is a division of the National Park Service. We have 14 students currently working for them, 14 graduates. And so government work is an option. We've had seven students actually work on the White House at some point in time. And I actually got one that's now there permanently because her hobby was gardening. Because she got to know people because she was there on the HBTC crew, position opened up the White House garden crew, and she got it. So
good for her.
That's what she's doing now for a career. Others will go to historic house museums. A lot of them, Monticello, Mount Vernon, Stratford Hall, Falling Water, Graceland. And so those are more for, I would say, family-oriented people. You know, the problem with big construction companies and the problem with HBTC is it tends to be a lot of traveling involved in the process. And so they're more geared for single man, married person with kids and stuff. And so the historic house museums and outdoor museums and things like that are better suited for a family life.
Mm-hmm. So HTBC, can you expand that?
HPTC, Historic Preservation Training Center. It's a division of the National Park Service. And what they do is it's kind of a, they don't really have a line item. They did on Park Service projects and then take their crews into that park and they work on those buildings alongside usually the maintenance staff of those parks. And the idea is that maintenance staff is going to learn some tips and techniques, working with them. And they're sure the park is assured that the job is going to get done right. These are fantastic tradespeople. One of the girls that just recently got hired by them, she's been working at Arlington National Cemetery. They're working on the amphitheater up there. So they've restored the wood doors in the theater. They've been doing a lot. HPTC has been doing a lot of work at Arlington the past couple of years. So just an example of some of the work. They did all the windows on Independence Hall in Philadelphia.
It's almost like a secret crew of people who are repairing and fixing things in the background that none of us know anything about.
Well, and actually, you know, a lot of the states are I just heard Virginia is trying to do it. Pennsylvania has, through their Historic Museum Commission, has a division that basically of a crew like that, that they have an Eastern and a Western crew that go around working on sites that are owned by the Historical Society, the Historical Society. And Virginia's trying to do the same thing. And the idea is that then some of those will go ahead if they don't have any work specifically for them. They can hire them out to like historic house museums and things to do work that way. It's growing, and it's an exact opposite of what happened in the 90s, where the privatization of our park systems and things tended to reduce the maintenance staff and the those kinds of crews throughout. So it's good that we're heading back in that direction. I know HPTC, I talked to the director not too long ago, and he said basically with the allocations that currently are going on, the funding to take care of the backlog of work that needs to be done in national parks, he's got authorization to hire up to like 300 people.
Yeah.
You know, anybody, anytime I have anybody interested in HPTC, I simply call Moss up and they take him with open arms.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, let's end today by telling listeners how they can find out more about your program. And we'll put all this information on the show notes too.
Well, yeah, you can call the college and talk to a college counselor. You can call me directly, or best way to reach me is probably through email. Actually pretty good at responding to email requests, but you can leave a message if you want to call. If it's better to phone, I'll leave a message and get back to you.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for being here today, Dave. And I really enjoyed finding out about the Building Preservation and Restoration Program and Belmont College and where these students go when they're done. So thank you.
Okay. I want to give you a shout out to Cole. I don't give his last name, but he's the one who basically turned me on to your program here. He's a regular listener. One of my students came up to me and said, you need to be on Stacy's program.
Yay.
And he works, he's put himself through school at night. So he's working night shifts and he's listening to your podcast when he's working at night shift at a Cabela's warehouse.
Cole, thank you so much for sending Dave my way. This is great. And thank you for listening. I just appreciate it so much. This show is such a joy to do. I enjoy all my guests and it's just so fun to put this show out there and see what happens.
Right.
I've met so many interesting people over the last 4 years. Yeah. All right. Well, we will talk soon. And thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to True Tales from Old Houses. And thank you to Dave Mertz and the rest of my guests this season. Greg, also known as Man with the Hammer. Elizabeth and Ethan Finkelstein from Cheap Old Houses. Keith Stahoyak. Denise, Molly, and Rihanna from the Ghost Story episode. Lisa Collins. Daniel Cantor. Susan and Will Brinson for being guests and for opening Stony Ford for our first live audience event. Joe Peterson. And Caitlin Parker. Many thanks to my Q&A buddies, Alex Santantonio, John Rogers, Aaron from Plunger, and my previous co-host, Devin Coldwell. And thank you to our Season 6 sponsors, The Window Course from Scott Seidler of The Craftsman Blog and the Plunger app. All of the coupon codes and information about these sponsors can be found on the True Tales from Old Houses website. And seriously, this show doesn't happen without help from our generous sponsors. Many thanks to the unsung heroes of True Tales from Old Houses, Nick and the crew on Sound Tech, Brendan and his staff for keeping the website working like a dream, and to Jason Shaw from Audionautics for all of our music. I will have fresh episodes for you on Monday, February 28th. Until then, to continue the conversation, be sure to follow True Tales from Old Houses and Blake Hill House on Facebook and Instagram. You can also become a patron on Patreon. During the break, I'll be posting more information about the Scotland and Northern Ireland trip and the projects here at Blake Hill House on the blog. And for more information about this episode, including photos, show notes, and to request a transcript, visit truetalesfromoldhouses.com. Until next time.